is I actually think the original one, this might be spoilery.
70s so one. I'm gonna, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. God damn it. Yes. When I say the original, that's the one I'm talking about. I haven't seen the other two or however fucking many there are. But saying the 70s one, the one with Kris Kristofferson and Barbra Streisand, takes too long.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. Just with me today.
Oh, and we are disagreeing already, even before recording this fucking thing.
Pre-game disagreeing. And maybe we'll pause it.
Oh, we're getting into it.
Okay.
Yeah, we're getting into
it. Let me introduce you first. You are Keith Foster. Okay,
but I'm coming in hot.
Keith Foster, coming in hot from San Diego.
That's right. And Cassidy Robinson, very wrong, in Los Angeles, California.
Okay, folks. I'll put this on Facebook because nobody actually responds when I say in the show. But if who was the biggest takeaway star of The Lord of the Rings? Was it...
I feel like there needs to be a little bit of context.
Okay.
We were talking about Christian Bale. And how Christian Bale's been kind of doing lower profile stuff.
Is Christian Bale a falling star?
Yeah. And I said that Christian Bale is kind of Elijah Wooding. Elijah Wood was the star of the three Lord of the Rings movies. Yeah. And now he just kind of does these sort of like oddball, quirky passion projects.
For sure.
Cassidy says that Christian Bale is Viggo Mortensen-ing.
Yes, which I agree. I understand it's not as, does not roll off the tongue as easily, but I think that it's more accurate.
I think you're only saying that because...
Elijah Wood is not a leading man. He was never going to be a leading man. He is a hobbit.
Fuck you. Hobbits can be leading men. No, I think that you were
saying...
Tell
that to Peter Jackson, because when he made The Hobbit in the three movies, he didn't even believe that.
Well, yeah. I think that you are only saying that because Viggo Mortensen is more of a Christian Bale type, but I'm saying their career trajectory is more similar.
Well, I think Christian Bale does want to be... a character actor. I think he thinks he's a character actor. I'm not so sure that he is, but he does have that same kind of itch that Elijah Wood has as far as like, I just want to like do something crazy. Like let's do a remake of Maniac from the first person or whatever.
That's exactly what I'm saying is he was in this really high profile franchise, the Batman franchise. And post that he's stepping back and doing just sort of these, like smaller sort of oddball projects that he's definitely interested in.
Yeah.
Whereas Viggo, that's what I'm saying. That's how I'm comparing him to Viggo. Obviously, you wouldn't see Christian Bale and Elijah Wood in the same, like up for the same role. Whereas that is a possibility with Viggo and Christian Bale. That's not what I was saying.
I see. Well, maybe this was all just a misunderstanding.
Well, maybe this is the closest I'm going to get to you admitting you're wrong. So let's move on.
We'll move on. I don't think I ever said this, but today we're going to be reviewing A Star Is Born, the newest Star Is Born. We did the old one a few weeks ago for Netflix homework, and now
beginning of October.
Yeah. Now we're going to be talking about the remake that just came out, the Bradley Cooper remake, and we are also going to finally review the horror film Teeth that we were supposed to do for Halloween. So it's kind of a weird episode. And I'm going to review the indie film, Jonah Hill's directorial debut, mid-90s. Let's start a little bit here with Obey Consume. What have we been watching? What have we been obsessed with lately?
I've got a couple things. So the first, the obvious one is Red Dead Redemption 2.
Ah, yes. I've seen this on the internet.
Yeah, it's massive. It's insane. It's beautiful. It is literally the most beautiful game I've ever played. And the most detailed game I've ever played.
Okay.
Cowboys, much more than Grand Theft Auto with a horse this time around.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool.
Well, it's been a while, right? Since the last
one. It's been a while since I played Red Dead Redemption.
Because
it's been a while.
We were living on Olympus. Which means nothing to nobody who isn't from Pocatello, but we were living in a really shitty basement apartment on Olympus when you were playing the first one, and that feels like 9,000 really? Years ago.
Was it that long ago?
Yeah. That was like when you first started dating your now wife.
No, I know that. I figured it was weird. Yeah, it's been a while. Yeah, so that's the obvi one I'm going to get out of the way. I have one more.
Okay.
Daredevil Season 3. Marvel Netflix is back, baby.
Did that come out already?
Yeah, it came out a couple weeks ago in October.
Oh, shit.
And post-Defenders, I haven't been able to get into the Marvel Netflix stuff. Like,
you made it longer than most people.
Yeah, I know. I actually finished Iron Fist Season 1.
Yeah,
but
didn't they just cancel Iron Fist and the other one?
Well, I think there's more Disney launching its own streaming services reasons.
Yeah, I've read those articles too.
But Daredevil Season 3 is so fucking good. The only one I feel like you should watch before that is Defenders, just so because there is.
I have no interest in watching that. I'd probably actually start watching season 2 of Iron Fist before I'd watch the Defenders show.
Did you watch season 1?
I watched about half of it.
Yeah, that's where I was at with The Punisher, and then I forgot that happened. To Luke Cage or Jessica Jones, but Season 3 has been so fucking good.
Well, that's the only one. To be fair, I've never watched Jessica Jones. It has a lot of fans. But Season 3, you're super into.
It is so good. I think it might be the best season yet.
Okay. All right.
It has some of the most incredible fight scenes I've seen for TV.
I feel like I have to watch like the last two episodes of Season 2 because I don't super remember how that concluded.
I think you're all right. If you watch Defenders, you're
I remember there was a lot of ninjas at some point.
Yeah, there was like all the stuff with Elektra.
Obey Consume, for me, was it last night? No, it was the night before, Saturday night, I went and saw the Menzingers live at the Regent after a full day of work. The place that I work, we were doing like this like sidewalk sale, and normally I have an office job, but they wanted, for some reason, the IT office to do this sale outside. So I was like running around sort of as a gopher, throwing away boxes and telling people where cheap shit was. So I was on my feet all day. And then and I haven't been working on my feet like that in a long time. So I was in searing agony. But I thought, you know what? I already bought the ticket. I have enough time to get there. It'll take about an hour plus to get to that side of town, so it'll let my feet rest a little bit. Oh my god, I was in so much pain through most of that concert. Because, of course, there's two opening acts I had to stand through. And I even tried to sit at some point. There's stairs to the balcony, kind of sat down in between sets. The band Tiny Moving Parts opened up, who I'm vaguely aware of. They're sort of a big deal in, like, online emo circles, and I always thought they were kind of an annoying band, and I thought they were an annoying band live too, but they put on an energetic show, I'll give them that. But I was sitting there texting or just looking at my phone or whatever, waiting for the next set to start, and somebody like would not let me sit because I was blocking what would be an exit on stairs, so I had to stand through the whole thing. But it was worth it because the Menzingers are an incredible live band. And if this was not 2018, if they came out in like 1998, they would be Foo Fighters level big. But I think they're that good of songwriters.
Oh, okay.
Like, as far as just like Foo Fighters in 1998, not now where they can like open Madison Square Garden or whatever. But
yeah.
But a really solid power pop band who writes good hooky chorusy songs. And there's not a lot of those left anymore.
I know the name, but I can't even think of a single song.
Well, you know, they're on Epitaph Records, and like they have like sort of a sizable punk audience, but not a whole lot of anything outside of that world. Like they, you know, the Regent was like a 1500 cap room that they filled pretty easily. And I don't want to like sit here and try to describe their music, but I'd say people who are like, who opine for the days of when the Foo Fighters or Weezer or like Green Day were like good bands, then should
Weezer covering Africa.
Yeah. Like pre all of them becoming dad rock. Like you should be listening to the Menzingers because it'll fill that gap.
I'm still into the Foo Fighters, but the rest I could kind of take or leave.
All right. So let's talk about movies. That's what we're here to do.
Movie news. Talk about that movie news.
We're going to try and catch up with this movie news about a month's worth. And we're going to do a lightning round.
So. Yeah, so you're just going to read sort of the headline to mm-hmm. me, and we're just going to sort of
quick riffs, hot takes, it
and move on.
Yeah. Exclusive, Mel Gibson to co-write and direct Wild Bunch remake at Warner Brothers.
My gut reaction is Mel Gibson's a really shitty racist. I get it. It makes sense. But do we need Mel Gibson working right now? I don't think so.
Okay, so you're kind of taking it on that angle. If I'm just looking at it as a genre thing, he kind of like makes sense as being like doing a super violent Western deal.
Yeah, he makes sense, but I just...
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. I have no enthusiasm for him really as a person anymore. Okay, next one. James Wan to develop a remake of the zombie train movie Train to Busan, which we've also done as Netflix homework.
I actually feel like this one is makes a lot of sense. James Wan is obviously comfortable in horror, mm-hmm. and I think the concept of Train to Busan was really fun. I think an American remake could be pretty cool.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I think the original is fine the way it is. I don't really feel like there's a whole lot they can add to it stylistically. But if there has to be an American remake, I feel like it's in good hands with James Wan. Okay, Bruce Dern replaces his friend Burt Reynolds in Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Burt Reynolds just recently died. I suppose he had a small part in that. What do you think?
I mean, you know, it's Quentin Tarantino.
Bruce Dern was a pretty big part in his last film.
Bruce Dern was great in Nebraska. Like mm-hmm. Bruce Dern's, he's a very accomplished actor. I mean, his new movie is already loaded with stars.
Yeah, big cast.
But you know, I don't know. In the past, I think even with his most loaded work, he's usually pretty good at navigating that and sort of bringing the best out of his actors. So, yeah.
It makes sense to me. I think the you know, classic 70s actors, masculine sort of like roles that they kind of filled at the time, the American everyman, lonely, you know, road traveler thing. So I think he can do a Burt Reynolds part pretty well.
Yeah.
Lady Gaga, who we'll be talking about later, fans accused of writing fake Venom reviews to support A Star Is Born. There's this whole thing going on right now, and this could almost be like a whole separate topic, but we'll try not to get into it. But there's this whole thing going on right now of like the fake news deal, and it's like, who's real on Twitter and who isn't? If you're on so-and-so's social media and you just see nothing but like 35 negative comments, and then you click on the account and it doesn't look like they do anything other than make negative comments on things. Then you then I was like, oh, are you like a paid bot or something like that? Like,
in most cases, probably. I just thought this story was kind of amusing.
Yeah.
Like, to me, just like what is the Venn diagram crossover of a Star is Born audience to Venom? It's like,
yeah.
It feels like the women who had to convince their boyfriends or husbands to go see A Star is Born instead of Venom that weekend or whatever. But I just thought it was kind of amusing. It probably happened with a few people, but I doubt it was like a big enough of a problem to really affect either's opening weekend.
I agree. I think Venom was a one weekend boom and bust, and whereas Star is Born is going to have longer legs.
Yeah. I just think it's like the idea of the stars, like the Lady Gaga fans being so sort of passionate, but at the same time insecure, is really amusing to me.
Okay. Continuing on the James Gunn story that we've been following all year, James Gunn to tackle Suicide Squad sequel for Warner Brothers. He's switched teams.
I'm not into this. I hated Suicide Squad so much that I would rather see, if he's going to move to DC, I would rather see him sort of like tackle something fresh, like a Green Lantern Corps or literally whatever. I feel like the Suicide Squad franchise is too poisoned. Let's burn it and not waste James Gunn on it. Also, I'm bummed that his horror movie hasn't come out yet. And if he's not going to be working for Guardians of the Galaxy, I would personally rather see him sort of do some more passion projects before getting right back into
big franchise. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
I would like to see him do like another kind of Slither or something like that. Just something to just be a palate cleanser and something that just has no studio interference and he really gets to do whatever he wants. And I think given everything that happened, he could end up making something really interesting. I think that I don't believe that Suicide Squad is completely unfixable. And I think that he has a similar enough sensibility for what's going on with that franchise and what that franchise wants to be that he could do something interesting with the sequel. I don't necessarily... that's not what I would want him to do. But if he does do it, I don't know. I'd be open to see what happens.
Well, he's just supposedly writing the script, right?
Yeah, and he was a screenwriter for a long time before he ever directed anyway.
Yeah.
So he could be trying to sort of fade back into that world.
I mean, maybe. I don't know. I agree. I think he could probably write a pretty good treatment. I think it's still going to depend on the director, and I've never cared about the Suicide Squad franchise. Like, even before the first movie came out, I was like, I guess. Mm.
Guillermo del Toro is directing Pinocchio for Netflix.
Yeah, that makes sense. My big bummer thing is that it's for Netflix.
Mm-hmm. He couldn't, depending on the scale and the size of the project, or if it's going to be one of more of his A pictures or B pictures, you know, there's a lot that goes into this. It could end up having a day and date release with maybe a limited theatrical run, too.
That could be cool. And who knows, maybe it's a sign that Netflix is trying to put a little more into their original movies.
Yeah, they have a few that are a little bit more geared towards award season and that kind of thing. That hasn't been what they've put a lot of their money into. But
they just did really good at the Emmys, so it would make sense for them to sort of try and step up their movie game as well.
Yeah.
I'm into it. I think Pinocchio makes so much sense as a story for Guillermo del Toro to work on. It sort of covers all of his fetishes.
For sure.
So,
and it's one of those long-time things he's been planning to do. So I think a studio like Netflix is more willing to take risks, even if they give him a smaller budget than something like Warner Brothers would give him.
But I also think Guillermo del Toro can work really well with a budget. I mean, we've seen it before, so.
Yeah. Okay, Clueless remake in the works from the Glow Girls Trip writers. Glow being the show on Netflix, the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, and Girls Trip being that Vegas movie.
Which Ashley really liked the movie, and we both really liked Glow. I just, no, like, why? It's such a time capsule mm-hmm. movie that I'm, like, let's, instead of doing a remake of Clueless or doing a remake of Mean Girls or whatever, like, let's just make the next one.
Yeah, no, like, let's that's the make, thing, is, like, nobody's really making teen movies anymore in that kind of way, like a super yeah. poppy, fun, big audience teen movie. You know, blockbuster teen movies are kind of not a thing anymore, and I think, I don't know, people, I don't know, Hollywood's annoying.
Well, they're like, trying to bank it off of this...
The success name, of a movie that's almost 20 years old.
Yeah, and spoke to a very different audience, and I don't think is, like, that much a part of the cultural zeitgeist. The target demographic for Clueless now is not gonna really know or care that it's a remake, so why not just, like, do something different?
Agreed.
I mean, this is one of your favorite movies, so I would think you probably think it's a little more sacred than I do. I just think it's kind of
yes and no. I feel like this is a situation where it's just such a bad idea from a marketing perspective, not even just on an aesthetic, like, you know, I care about this movie kind of thing, but just as, like, as an IP to remake, it's a really dumb one to do because of all the reasons you already laid out. I think if they make it, it's not going to really make any kind of effect in the world of cinema. It's not going to make the old one look like a worse movie, or people are going to remember it, the new one, more than the old one. It's just going to be this thing that comes out and flops and everyone will forget.
Yeah, I feel like this is just like when they recently remade the Poltergeist.
Yeah, or when the thousands of horror movies they remake that nobody sees, yet they still keep doing. Or like when they remade Arthur with Russell Brand. You remember that?
Yeah, that's a good example.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all this is, so I just don't care.
Okay, strap in, everybody, because Avatar's second and third sequels are done filming, and... they've already started pre-productions on Avatars 4 and 5.
Okay, I have to admit, I appreciate how much they're, like...
They're just putting all their chips down. On this incredibly expensive bet.
Yeah, I I so do not care, and I hope they flop. I mean... I think the reason that the first Avatar was so successful was largely due to the technology at the time.
Sure.
And I don't see them sort of topping that. Mm. And I don't think there's enough story there to really hang an entire franchise around. And we've been hearing rumors about these sequels forever. I mean, Avatar's what, like... 10 years old
now? Yeah, 2009. So it's almost 10 years old.
Yeah. It's like,
and it's left no mark in the world of cinema. Like, considering it's like the highest grossing film of all time, and, you know, I think for a while it was the largest selling Blu-ray of all time, like when Blu-ray was just starting to, like, become the norm.
But all it is a name on a paper that people are hoping every other movie.
Yeah, all it is it's a stat on a spreadsheet.
Yeah, I mean, every time, like, you know, one of these big Star Wars movies or Marvel movies comes out, I always see an article that's like, will this finally be Avatar? We're sick of this being in our history as the most successful movie ever made.
And not to say, like, not to disparage Avatar that much. I don't think it's fine. But it just, like, if you think about the greatest action films of all time, and you think about, like, you know, like, even other James Cameron films like Terminator 2 or Aliens or whatever, nobody quotes Avatar. Nobody dresses as Na'vi for Comic-Con. No, it's not in the cultural zeitgeist. It's left no impression.
Yeah, I mean...
I don't think anybody who was, like, a kid when Avatar came out, like, if you were, like, 5, 6, 7, and now you would be 15, 16, 17, are they really going to, like, fuck, yeah, this is, like, my Aliens, or this is my Terminator 2?
Were there even, like, Avatar toys?
Yeah, you know, there were, but, like, eh.
I do think it is funny that they've ditched the papyrus font and have a brand new logo that I also think looks equally shitty.
Yeah, but nothing could literally be more of a cosmetic fix.
Yeah, it's, I just,
I mean, we'll
see.
We'll see. We'll see a trailer. We'll see what they're up to here. Maybe this is the, maybe he, James Cameron has never lost money. Ever.
I think he's going to.
I mean,
I think that I don't think anybody cares.
I don't either.
And
unless the marketing is just so ubiquitous and huge and monolithic, and like they just shove it down people's throats so much, and there's all these movies coming out
which they will.
If they can create enough, like if they can astroturf hype for this movie, then maybe they can trick people into thinking they cared 10 years ago.
I'm predicting that this is going to be, what was that fucking movie by the Wachowskis where Channing Tatum was half dog?
Jupiter Ascending.
Yeah, I think it's going to be that. It's going to be this big, expensive looking mess that the studio has all this faith in based solely on the name. Avatar isn't a franchise yet, and I don't think it's going to become one.
Yeah. I agree. And that was kind of our lightning round for the news.
I think we did pretty good.
We did
good
for us. Like, we did great.
Yeah.
I'm fairly proud. But let's go ahead and start with the movie reviews. And actually, you know what? I think I'm going to change this up from what I originally said. I'm going to do a little solo review here first for mid-90s. Okay, so mid-90s is Jonah Hill's directorial debut. He wrote and directed it, and it stars Catherine Waterston, Lucas Hedges, who's going to be in every movie for the rest of the year, Sonny Suljic as the main character Stevie. Stevie is like a 12, 13-year-old kid. He lives with a single mother, played by Catherine Waterston, his older brother, played by Lucas Hedges. You know, he's kind of a latchkey kid. She's sort of seeing guys, you know, she's a young mother and sort of trying to fend for the family, but also trying to have a social life at the same time. They live somewhere in West LA, kind of undisclosed. You know, he's kind of keeps to himself. His brother is not like super supportive. Like, there's a lot of like implied history that you learn about this family going into the movie, which is that older brother maybe got into some trouble at some time and is trying to sort of keep a low profile, but is sort of brooding and holding a lot inside. Well, Stevie's just trying to kind of find his way in the world. He's reached a certain age where he's doesn't really feel like a kid anymore, doesn't want to project being a kid. He wants to sort of be cool. He wants to sort of find his own personality, find his tribe. And he does at a skate shop sort of nearby his house, even though he doesn't know how to skate. He hangs out there one afternoon. There's a bunch of kind of burnouts and stoners sitting on a couch, watching skate videos and shooting the shit, and he decides that's who I want to be. These are the cool kids. So he sort of follows them around until he officially becomes part of their group. He sells some video games to buy his older brother's old sort of toy skateboard, and falls on his ass a lot until he can follow his friends around, and then he kind of just gets into early teenage life of getting into trouble, skating in places they're not allowed to be, being, you know, running away from the police, smoking pot for the first time, meeting girls, whatever. And it's kind of an observational film. If you've seen the trailer, you know that it's super low budget. There's mostly non-actors, including the kid who plays Stevie. Lucas Hedges and Catherine Waterston are the biggest names in here who are like established actors who do this for a living. A lot of the side cast who play his skater friends were found on Casting Call, or they're professional skaters or that kind of stuff. Olin Prenet plays the sort of class clown of the group, fuck shit. They all have these funny nicknames. Ryder McLaughlin plays fourth grade, who's actually like maybe in 11th grade in the movie. Nikhil Smith plays sort of the leader of the pack named Ray. He's sort of the wise beyond his years guy who sort of brings everybody together. He's super nice to our lead character when he doesn't have to be, and sort of shows him the ropes and whatnot. And he's probably the one who's going to make it out. Yeah, you know, he's a really, really talented skater. He's already getting eyes from some professionals in the industry, and he's trying to, you know, break out of being sort of a poor city kid and getting into a real career for himself. But he feels like some of his other friends are holding him back. So you have this interesting dynamic where Stevie is escaping the life of being in the shadow of his older brother and being sort of a fly on the wall in his family, and wants to enter into adolescence and thinks that, you know, these burnouts and drunks are the cool kids. And then you have this older kid who's the leader of the pack, who's like, I kind of want to escape this and try and find a real life. And I think that little dynamic is interesting and cool, and plays out really well. And there's a lot of all of these dynamics that I'm talking about are almost all shown, you know, these all through behavior. There's very few times in dialogue where any of this comes up. This is just stuff you sort of get as you're watching the film, which is the way you do it. Now, the movie's called Mid-90s, and it takes place in the mid-90s, but luckily there's not a lot of, like, pop culture references for the sake of it. It started a little bit like that in, like, the first 5 minutes, when we're seeing the bedroom and, like, some of the t-shirts and that kind of stuff. I was like, oh, this is going to be, like, pop culture heavy, but then it kind of abandons that pretty quickly and becomes much, much more a strict character study, and a really good one. It kind of ends abruptly. I was expecting a little bit more to it by the time it was done, but it is sort of a good debut film, and it feels very real, the verisimilitude and the production design. And I have a friend at work who went and saw it, and he lived in these exact neighborhoods at that time, skating in those exact spots, and he said, this was just my life. I just watched my life for an hour and a half. I could feel that sort of authenticity, even though that wasn't my life and I wasn't in those places at that time. It feels documentary-like. Very similar. I said in my review, my written review, that even though the movie's called Mid-90s, I think more than just sort of referencing pop culture or whatever, he's sort of, Jonah Hill is referencing the type of films that were made, the independent film that came from the mid-90s, films like Larry Clark's Kids or Ken Park, or some of the films of Gus Van Sant, like My Own Private Idaho, or later on films like Paranoid Park or Elephant, and where he used a lot of non-actors and had the sort of photogenic like street photography style and that kind of stuff. So I definitely recommend it. I think it was a really good little movie. It's I don't think it's going to like blow up, but it's definitely a good foundation for Jonah Hill to kind of start to make a name for himself as a director, because he has some knack for it.
Well, that's good, because his SNL was not great.
Okay, I can't speak to that, but I really did enjoy this movie.
Cool. Do you want to give it a letter grade?
It's like a B+, A-, somewhere in there. It is really good as what it wants to be.
Okay, cool.
All right, let's get into the remake, the 2018 remake of A Star Is Born, and I'll let you set that up.
All right. I feel like we just set this up. if you listen to our review of the 70s, the story here is essentially the same. There's this woman who is a singer who's sort of taken for granted, isn't appreciated for her voice. And there is this, you know, she's just sort of this amateur, just kind of goes up to open mics when she can. It does drag shows kind of thing. just, you know, gets whatever stage time she can. Doesn't really see music as a career. It's just sort of her passion. And she happens to meet this very famous, you know, sort of country rock star who, an alcoholic, he's sort of burning out. But he meets her and sees her potential as an artist. So he lifts her out of the doldrums and into this career of fame and fortune. He basically does everything he can to sign her a rich and famous check.
Mm-hmm.
And then their relationship struggles as her star sort of starts to eclipse his. But yeah, and then it's just sort of about their relationship and the struggle with alcoholism and fame.
Right. And Bradley Cooper, who also directed the film, plays opposite Lady Gaga as yes. this star. What is his name in the movie?
Jackson Maine.
Jackson Maine. And Lady Maine. Gaga playing Allie. Yeah, you know, it was interesting that we had just seen this movie. Pretty much.
My big thing was I kept comparing it to the 70s version, which was sort of a weird, I think, mindset to go into it. So, there was some stuff. I was surprised that there was some stuff that I liked from the 70s version more. But then there was stuff that I liked from this version more. There were a few things I kind of went back and forth on.
Yeah, kind of me too. But I actually, what I think surprised me is how much I wasn't comparing it. Because obviously I knew what all the plot beats were going to be. And I knew what the structure of this is. Yeah. And there's a sort of safeness or familiarity there that guided me through, but from that point I was really kind of taken with the performances, which I think Bradley Cooper being an actor and is this his debut film? Did he make another movie before this?
No, this okay. is his
two
debut,
actors turned directors in this episode. Whenever an actor makes films, I always usually notice they're very actorly and they're
especially
very
when they're
performance driven.
Especially when they are first starting.
Yeah. I mean, there's exceptions, Clint Eastwood and a few others who make more sort of straightforward genre stuff. But I think Bradley Cooper here is very, very interested in getting into the emotional states of these characters.
Yes.
Much more than I would say the 70s film did. Other than that movie did a little bit, but I think this movie really is about what is the core relationship between these two, mm-hmm. and sort of the balancing
it's
of
also
ego with infatuation, with attraction. And I think those kind of close to the camera, heavy breathing kind of performances is what comes through here way more than even just that familiar rise and fall story that we see all over the place and have seen three other times in this. It's not a franchise, but, you know, legacy film.
Yeah, I think also, along with that, I think just the characters, aside from showcasing Barbara Streisand's musical ability, it is much more about making them full characters. Like, Jackson Maine is a much more sympathetic alcoholic.
Yeah.
And a much more realistic portrayal of alcoholism. While I did enjoy Kris Kristofferson's sort of over the top, rock legend kind of persona. Jackson Maine feels like a real guy with a real problem and someone who is genuinely charming and seems like he'd be fun to be around until the party goes on too long.
Yeah. And she even knows. From their first meeting that he has a problem because, you know, she hurts her hand. They go to get like some supplies and he's already still buying alcohol well into 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever it is. So she already has those red flags. And Andrew Dice Clay, who shows up every once in a while in movies and is like really good now.
Yeah. Dice Man.
He plays her father.
I'm a good actor.
He plays her father in the movie, and I think she has sort of a family history with alcoholism and that kind of stuff. So her
also that's something I think this movie does really well in comparison to the 70s version.
Yeah.
Is it really flushes out the world more than just sort of this bleary-eyed romance at each other. In this version, the main rock star, his manager is also his brother, played by Sam Neill.
Sam Elliott.
Sam Elliott, yes. Who gives his very dependable Sam Elliott performance.
Yeah.
But it really rounds out the world a lot more and feels a lot more sort of lived in and three-dimensional than
that was a good angle to take. I think that's what the movie does. What this movie, I think, does really well is that it has that sturdy structure that they can kind of move in and out of and do whatever they want as long as they kind of stay within those beats. And while doing that, they did a really good job at grounding the characters and making them more and more sympathetic so that when we get to sort of the more predictable stuff, then
yeah, like there's the downward spiral and
right. Yeah. Then there's an emotional reality to, and something that makes sense in those sequence of events. Whereas in the 70s version, one of the criticisms we both had was that by the 75% mark, we're starting to feel the movie lull quite a bit. We're not caring quite as much as we would like to about the relationship. And I think this movie actually definitely fixes that for me. I care way more about the relationship stuff here than I did in the 70s film. How did you think this one compares as a musical?
Yeah, so I mean, the music is very different than the 70s version because it's obviously,
contemporary.
Different time.
Yeah.
The music is, the thing I thought was really cool was there were some of like Bradley Cooper's songs as this sort of, you know, country rock star that actually reminded me a lot of Kris Kristofferson's songs.
Oh, interesting.
So I thought that,
yeah,
like there was this sort of really rockin' one with the like kick drum beat, like
yeah,
that really reminded me of the Kris Kristofferson one. So to me, it was like that music felt like a natural progression. And I honestly can't think of anyone else besides Lady Gaga who is sort of that Barbara Streisand level diva right now.
Yeah, I mean, some could say Beyonce, I suppose. Like, she's huge.
Yeah, I guess that's true. But it just makes so much sense for her to sort of fill that role.
Yeah.
And I mean, the music's great. I think, Lady Gaga fans are going to have a lot to like here.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the sort of ballady stuff. I don't think it feels as much like a musical, though. Like, this feels more like a song. You know, this feels more like a sort of biography, fictional biography with music in it.
Yeah.
Whereas the previous version was like, you know, this is a Barbra Streisand showcase.
Yeah.
With a story around it.
Right. But I think that the 70s film had diverged from the other two versions, the 30s and the 50s version, by having the music be diegetic. So when they're singing on stage, everyone in the movie knows that they're singing on a stage. they're not singing about the movie, about being in a movie.
I actually didn't know that about the previous version.
Yeah, I think that was the first one that made that change. Whereas like the 50s one with Judy Garland and the one before that, they were much more traditional, kind of like now we're singing, thing. But I think that there was, and I maybe mentioned this the last time, there's a kind of a tension there between old Hollywood and new Hollywood, sort of grinding the gears in the 70s version. Whereas I think this one really kind of smoothed that out. So when they do go into the musical sequences, it doesn't...
It feels much more natural.
It feels more naturalistic, yeah. And it's still diegetic, but it also doesn't feel like the camera loses objectivity or something like that.
No, I feel like in general, it's just, you know, it's a much more modern film with much more modern pacing.
Yeah.
And it keeps my attention the whole way through, yeah. Which the previous version did not.
It's still 2 hours and 16 minutes, and it's still somehow the shortest one. they keep getting shorter by like 10 minutes.
Now, the only thing I do want to say is I actually think, so this might be kind of spoilery, so if you haven't seen it, just, I guess, be prepared. If you haven't seen any versions that exist.
Yeah.
But I feel like I sort of liked what the ending to the 70s one said a little bit more. I felt like the ending to this one was a little rushed. Because it's all this buildup, and then there's this, you know, sort of emotional punch. And in the Streisand version, she sort of has to deal with that for a little bit longer.
Right.
So it feels a little more real. In this version, it feels a little romanticized to me. And I feel like Lady Gaga got a little shortchanged with her final sort of ballad.
Her
final power ballad. Yeah, because in the 70s version, it's just sort of this long extended shot of Barbara Streisand. And it feels very empowering. It feels very like I survived this relationship.
Right.
Like, toxicity and everything, and I came out on top of it. And you know, in this one, I didn't like how it kept during her performance, it kept sort of like doing these flashbacks to the relationship, which to me, that was the difference in the focus. And in the 70s version, it was like this big, beautiful, powerful moment for her. And in this one, I felt like that moment was sort of taken away from Gaga, and instead it was like, let's romanticize this relationship a little bit, and to me that's a little flawed.
I think you're on to something there. And actually, I watched a video essay where they talked about all four versions in some amount of detail, and they were kind of comparing the characters and how they're portrayed, and they said that, like, The observation that the video made was that the 70s one was kind of coming around at the time of, like, women's liberation. And so they wanted to portray the character as being this strong, independent woman. She lives alone in that film. She has her own career. She you know, sort of takes everything by the reins herself. For the most part, she needs the leg up by Chris Christopherson. But once she has it, it's very much she's doing her own thing. Whereas in this one, and I think it's compared a little bit more to some of the earlier versions, the character is a little bit more passive and a little bit more like taking things as they come, and seems a little bit more of a passenger in the relationship as well. And I think...
Well, and for the most part, I actually liked that sort of more as far as a storytelling device, because...
Yeah.
You really see how it sort of starts to fall apart for Bradley Cooper's character, and how this, you know, these toxic cycles sort of keep driving him back to his bad behavior.
But does the movie risk, you know, and there's plenty of opinions to be had here, but does the movie risk becoming too much about Bradley Cooper ultimately?
I think at the end it kind of does, and it's that's what I mean. It's sort of frustrating because I think that the ending has this opportunity for her to sort of take her power back,
mm-hmm.
And I didn't get that, and I didn't realize how much I would want that.
Yeah.
But especially in the times that we're in, it feels a little off of what the culture of Zeitgeist, I think,
would want for that character.
Pushing. Yeah. So it was sort of surprising, and just that ending was a little disappointing to me. But for the most part, I was thoroughly entertained with the movie. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I just, and I probably wouldn't have noticed it if we hadn't just watched the other one.
Yeah.
But I just felt like I wanted this, like, moment for Gaga to just, like, be on her own and just, and we get that. I mean, we do get it. It just feels like it is a little more focused on Jackson Maine. So,
yeah. Bradley Cooper co-wrote this and he directed it and he's starring in it. I don't know if that happened on accident. Like he's
fucking phenomenal.
No, he's great in this. I think he's definitely going to get a nomination out of this. Probably Lady Gaga too. And I'm sure there'll be some song nominations, but
I think
he's the safer bet as far as that goes.
Well, he does feel much more the main character.
Yeah, and I wonder if that happened circumstantially, just because he was directing it, he was writing it, it was his project, and it just kind of geared that direction. The movie just sort of steered itself that way. Like, they didn't make a correction for that, which isn't to say that the movie has to be more about Lady Gaga, other than it's called A Star Is Born, and it's
mm-hmm.
But it's interesting that it kind of got baked that way.
If it was, yeah.
Yeah, he's great in this. He might get a nom for it too.
I think, the most emotional moment for me was this very sort of quiet scene between Sam Elliott and Bradley Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
Holy fuck. It was just like, it was an actor's dream, because there was very little dialogue in between them, and it was just everything sort of set on their face, and mm-hmm. he just killed it.
And that might have been a thing that they like kind of worked out on the day of. Like, that's what I'm talking about. Like, those actors turned directors, is they're much more sensitive to like rehearsal and like feeling each other out and letting people try different things. Like the all those sequences with Dave Chappelle, I'm sure that was probably like 90% improvised. And that's cool. The movie has a looseness to it that the other ones don't. So I think that I liked this movie. I do think it is maybe stronger in individual scenes than as an overall package.
I would agree with that.
But I certainly had a lot of, like, I don't know, fun. It kind of feels like a big production, and it's sort of romanticized in a big way that you don't see anymore. So,
remember when I said this with fucking La La Land, that we're going to get more of this. People want romanticism right now. They want to go to the movies and feel good mm-hmm. and feel bad in a way that's not related to terror or explosions. Like, it does not surprise me that this movie is doing well at all. Like,
yeah.
I've noticed this year I've been enjoying a lot more movies that like this that I, you know, normally the big summer action superhero flicks are my jam, but
yeah.
I've been enjoying the sort of return to character driven and romance driven movies. So
for sure.
I don't think it's unfair to say this movie's fun. It's, you know, Lady Gaga is discovered singing in a fucking drag review, like,
yeah,
with notable famous drag queens. It's a lot of fun.
It's big in all the ways you want it to be, but also very, very intimate, which is what I think is really separates this from the other version we reviewed. But I give it a B+. I don't remember. A- maybe.
That's what I give it a B. I would give it a strong B+.
Yeah.
Borderline A-. But really, there's one question we didn't answer.
Mm-hmm.
Who has the better voice? Streisand or Gaga?
Oh, Streisand. I'm not even a Barbra Streisand fan. Like, generally, I can recognize that she has a much stronger singing voice, at least in the movie.
I mean, be prepared for the entire gay community to turn on this podcast, but I kind of agree.
Yeah.
I mean, Lady Gaga is fucking great, sure, and her songs are so good, but man, I just remember, like, I was not that familiar with Barbara Streisand before watching the, like, I was aware of her as a cultural entity.
Yeah, yeah.
But I wasn't aware of, like, sort of why she was famous. But, and then,
like, that's when you finally got, like, oh, okay, this is what the big deal is.
Yeah, I was like, holy fuck, I would totally see this bitch in Vegas.
Yeah, and, you know, Lady Gaga, like, has her fans and stuff. But I think it's also indicative of the type of music they're singing. Like, they don't really write belters in the same way for Gaga in this movie that Streisand does. And that's not necessarily what's cool now or what's modern. So
I did appreciate the sort of meta commentary, the sort of postmodern stuff that.
Yeah, there's definitely kind of her talking about her own career, like when she's talking about, like, you know, the dancers and the big productions and that kind of stuff, and, like, doesn't want to look ridiculous, but at the same time she has to sort of,
and just like,
yeah,
the pressure from the record label and stuff. So I think, again, that just sort of goes back to the way this feels a little more real and a little more lived in than the 70s version. But I really appreciated sort of the angles that they approach the subject matter from.
Yeah. Cool. Well, let's talk about something completely different now and get to what was supposed to be our Netflix homework with Richard, but we had a long enough episode. There was no way we were going to be able to fit it in. I assigned you the 2007 horror comedy Teeth, a very infamous kind of independent horror film that everyone, I felt like around that time, everyone was sort of talking about it, but I didn't know a lot of people who had actually seen it. The concept of the film being a sort of virginal teenager who is taking a vow of chastity, and she's wearing a promise ring and that kind of thing. She does speaking engagements with other teenage chastity enthusiasts, talking about, like, the virtues of saving yourself for marriage and that kind of thing. And she finds out through a crush and some things that happen, developments and plot, that she may have vagina dentata, which is an old myth that goes back centuries in a lot of different cultures about women who have vagina teeth. Which sounds ridiculous, and it is. But I think what saves this from just being ridiculous exploitation or just so concept-driven that it's hard to actually take it seriously as anything, is that the filmmaker, writer-director, Mitchell Lichtenstein?
I thought it was a woman.
No.
Yep, that's Mitchell and not Michelle.
Mitchell Lichtenstein, who kind of comes at this at a very satirical point of view. I got very early on that he went to the school of John Waters and Todd Solondz, School of Snark. That comes through pretty heavily. And I think that sort of distanced removal from the events as we see them, even from the characters, like, she sort of takes on more and more agency as the movie goes, and she's learning about this, and it's all, you know, a metaphor about female sexuality and empowerment and learning about and the way that men sort of use women. Actually, it's in a post-Me Too era, very interesting movie that I'm surprised more people aren't talking about in some ways. And maybe they will now that it's available on Netflix. But I was actually surprised at how legitimate this ended up being and not just like a gross out weirdo gonzo concept movie. It actually, I think, stands up pretty well with something sort of, I would say, in the same ballpark as like Welcome to the Dollhouse, or maybe not quite as sophisticated, but in the ballpark of something like Election or even Heathers, kind of in that world.
Okay. I'm sort of torn on this movie because there were times when I agree with your assessment and that I got that it was supposed to be sort of campy and schlocky, and then there were times I felt like tonally this movie was a little all over the place for me. You said you got early on that it was the satirical thing. And I sort of got that as well, but I was also like,
when you see her doing her like speaking engagement with like the red rings and all that, and the way that the kids are like enthusiastically like cheering on Chastity.
No, I got that. I got that. I also didn't really like it. It felt more like. Like, I didn't really get the sort of humor element that satire usually has. Uh-huh. It almost felt more like, I don't know, like I don't know how to describe it, because I definitely got that it was saying, hey, this is ridiculous. But usually when I think of satire, it has some sort of a heavy humor element to it. And I didn't really get that a lot in this. There were times when it was like, oh, okay, this is also campy and funny. Mm-hmm. But then there were times when it was like, I don't know, it just felt very tonally all over the place for me.
See, I think it's riding a line, for sure. I think that it is pushing decency, and that's why I said John Waters comes to mind. I think this director must have been a fan, because only he would have thought of something like Vagina Teeth. Playing it as a symbol of female empowerment. But I think that
But what I mean, though, is like there's a scene where she's graphically raped in a cave.
Yeah.
And then we cut to the next time when she's being molested by a gynecologist.
Yeah.
And he's fisting her and gets his fingers bitten off and literally starts screaming, vagina dentata, vagina dentata. Right. Like, there was a tonal dissonance for me.
No, I get what you're saying. That's what I'm saying is, by it rides a line. And I think that it came out in 2007, maybe certain scenes wouldn't have been done the same way. There are things that just seem a little kind of dated a little.
I get that it was writing a line. I guess I'm just saying that it wasn't always successful for me. I don't know.
I got very, very, very close to the point of losing it. Like, there were a few times where I was like, okay, this is kind of gross. And, like, I don't want to just watch this girl continually getting raped or whatever. But I felt like that the movie... it was balanced enough with absurdism and satire, and I felt the inherent black comedy in most of it. Even at times when it was really dark, I felt like, oh, okay, there's a point to this. Like there's, I don't know. Maybe I'm just
I get what you're saying. Like that's sort of how I came away from this movie was I didn't hate it. I don't want anybody to think I hated it, because I do think that there are a lot of interesting things at play.
Yeah.
There were moments when I was like, do I hate this? But then it would win me back. So like the beginning, I felt like it was sort of, operating in the same world as the movie Saved.
Yeah.
But not as funny. And I think that's maybe where it was lacking a little bit to me was I got that it had this satire. I just didn't get the sense of humor all the time. And I think that sort of tonal imbalance maybe could have been handled a little better.
I'll agree in that. I don't think the movie is as funny as it thinks it always is. And I think that a lot of the more obvious setups and the more obvious, like, snarky dialogue and that kind of stuff, those things don't crackle as much as the movies it's going to remind you of, something like Heathers, or certainly something like Election. But I do think that when the movie is operating really well, is more on letting the events unfold as they do, and then getting, and the actors who I think for the most part are really good in the movie, especially the lead.
Yeah, I was surprised because I've never really heard of her.
She's done a lot of TV. I kind of looked too because I was like, where have you been my whole life? Like,
yeah, she was pretty
you
great.
Should definitely be in more stuff. Jess Wixler.
I don't know.
Yeah, she's been a lot of TV, but I think she's really good in this, and I think that her performance really, really anchors all of the heavy tonal lifting in this movie, because
I agree.
If you had somebody who wasn't nearly as in on the joke as she clearly is, then the dark scenes would not work at all.
And she's I agree completely. I think maybe the problem was conceptually, I feel like conceptually the story, the movie was there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like with the story of this, you know, chastity Christian with vagina teeth as sort of this physical manifestation of this guilt.
Yeah.
I think that's great. That's, you know, in mm-hmm. The way men take advantage of women. I think my problem with it was there wasn't really anywhere for the story to go once she discovered, like once she sort of is empowered by it.
Yeah.
The movie doesn't have anywhere to go. Like the brother sort of villain, I could have done without that completely. Like,
I kind of agree. And it's also underbaked. Anything. Like, there's this implied history there that I'm never quite like with. I'm like, I don't know what you're trying to say with this, really.
Yeah. And he's, and it's sort of built up like he's sort of this final villain or whatever. And I just don't think anything with him worked at all.
And there's these plot mechanics level that are kind of baked into it early with like this sick mother and stuff. And it all kind of like comes to a head. But it's, like some of that stuff is a little clunky.
I think this sort of chunk in the middle, pun intended. pun unintended. Like sort of once she discovers the vagina teeth,
mm-hmm.
to like the incident with like the first boy,
yeah.
who, the incident after the other person in her group, yeah. I feel like that is where the movie sort of functioned the best.
Yeah.
I feel like maybe there just wasn't quite enough for a whole movie there. I don't know.
It's not perfect. I would never claim it to be. I guess the thing is, I'm okay with its trashiness because I get the camp vibe that it's going for.
Yeah, and I can see it sort of living as this cult classic.
Yeah, and I'm kind of sympathetic to that sort of like those imperfect sort of culty things. Like, it reminded me a decent amount of like early Greg Araki films. Like, it has that kind of like thumbing your fist to, you know, something like the Doom Generation, like that, like these sort of purposely unlikable movies.
I kind of wish it had sort of decided more if it wanted to be unlikable and gross out,
yeah.
or if it wanted to be sort of a teen comedy, because there were times when it felt like it should have been rated PG-13. And like I said in the previous podcast, I started watching it at work,
yeah.
and there are many severed dicks, much, much crotch bleeding, much more crotch bleeding than I was expecting.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty gross. And I think that's what I mean when I just say tonally. Like, I kind of wish it had sort of picked one or the other. Like, I think it could have worked either way.
It could have probably actually pushed the horror element more. If they were going to go that direction. But I kind of like where it sits. It's a little bit more interesting, I think, than if they had just turned it into Evil Dead Vagina.
Yeah.
I think they marketed it as a horror film because how else would you? But I don't think that's necessarily genre where it is. I think it is much closer to something like a Doom Generation or a Heathers or a But I'm a Cheerleader, like that kind of world.
Yeah, I just really the climax is where I think that's where it needed to either like
find double down.
Yeah, yeah, it just this movie feels like it builds to nothing.
I kind of agree with that. Yeah.
But
it's like an interesting, I would recommend in a video store kind of like environment, C+.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree with that. Or if you just want to watch something really weird and gross with your friends.
Yeah. But I will say that if you end up seeing this only because you've heard of it and you're sort of just daring yourself to like, oh my God, it's not going to be as, oh my God, as you think it is. Like, it's not like watching, like, the guinea pig films or, like, Cannibal Holocaust or something.
Or Human Centipede.
I don't even think Human Centipede is as Human Centipede as it thinks it is. But...
No, I know, but...
But yes, it's not just something to shock and this is a little bit more of a real movie than that.
Yeah. And what I mean is we literally watched Human Centipede just to see people's mouths getting sewn to their buttholes. Like,
right,
yeah. There's a little more going on here than this is just a chick with teeth in her twat.
Thanks. All right. Well, that's the episode. Oh, what are you going to assign me for next week?
We are going to watch the 2017 Christian Bale cowboy drama, period drama. You can blame me playing hours and hours and hours of Red Dead Redemption 2 on this. Hostiles.
All right. So, yeah, we'll be talking about that next week. And if anybody has any opinions about any of the things we talked about in this episode, you can contact us at our email at jabberandthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter, facebook.com/jabberpodcast, or Twitter and Instagram at jabberpodcast. Follow me individually on Twitter at BC Cassidy, V as in Victor. You can read my reviews that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal at southforkreviews.blogspot.com. Although I'm not really posting there anymore, I think I'm going to start just posting directly from the Idaho State Journal website. So once I have what that address is, I'll start saying that instead. You can stream the podcast and listen to it on your favorite podcatcher. What are we on? We're on player.fm, Pocket Casts, the Windows Podcast Network, Google Play, and, Stitcher and iTunes. You have things, say them.
Go to my website, www.fosterkid.com. I've added a couple new show dates. This month for book club, the improvised book genre, we are doing an improvised heist.
Okay.
That'll be Saturday, November 10th at 9 p.m. We might be doing one other show this month, but it's a little up in the air due to Thanksgiving holiday. Falls on the week we normally do a show, so I'll let you know. Also, this Friday, so just after this comes out, I was hoping to promote this a little bit more. I'm doing an alternative comedy showcase at Old Town Improv Company. It's just meant to sort of showcase sort of the weirder side of stand-up and that you don't really get to see at comedy clubs. So, you know, it could feature sketches or characters or just kind of just meant to be a little more open-ended creatively.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Alt Comedia, an alternative comedy show. And it will be at Old Town Improv Company Friday, November 9th at 9:30. So that's Alt Comedia Friday, November 9th, 9:30, and Book Club and Improvised Heist Saturday at 10. Both are at Old Town Improv Company. You can get tickets at Old Town Improv OldTownImprov.com, and it actually really helps our shows out a lot if you are in the San Diego area and you think you might come to the show. It really helps out a lot if you buy tickets online, just so we can get a sense of, you know, numbers for the show beforehand. There's also links on my website to buy tickets. And if anybody wants any comps, like, send me a message and yeah.
Slide into those DMs.
You can follow me on Instagram at Keith Foster Kid. And I'm not even going to fucking plug Twitter anymore because I don't really get on it.
All right.
I'm so close to deleting my account.
You say that every week. Yeah, I'll be sure to check out our friends out there who are also doing podcasts. Patrick sort of hinted a little bit that he was going to release some information about Almost Educational today, and then he didn't. So, but we'll see. That's more activity than I've seen from him in a while. So hopefully Patrick and Dennis come back with Almost Educational. Possibly, I've also heard rumblings, some internet stuff out there about Rod over there at the listening party. Also check out Bill and Brian at the Great Albums podcast, which I will be a guest at some point. And check out Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places and Mike Fallick over at Hack Thought.
Also check out Adam Connie at the Adamant podcast and Marilyn Bowe at Campfire Shit Show.
Okay, and that's the show.
Hey, I just wanted to get one last look at you.